A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Right in the future, keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be checking in with our friend Stephen Gutowski of The Reload here in just a minute or two. I want to get Stephen's thoughts on what's the next big 2A story. I mean, now that the one big beautiful bill has been signed, we know that the taxes on suppressors or barreled firearms, any other weapons, are going to get zeroed out as of January the 1st. We know that the NFA is being challenged in its entirety by almost every Second Amendment organization out there. What's the next big 2A story? You know, the ATF supposedly was going to release, 50 rules and regulation changes on the 4th of July. We were told that last week. That didn't happen, so maybe that's on the horizon. But we'll get Stephen's thoughts on, what is the next big story for gun owners headed down the pike? Do we have to wait till the fall when the Supreme Court gets back after its summer recess and starts considering some of the 2A cases that'll be pending in conference? Do we have any legislation bumping around in the states? I don't know. Let's talk about it with Stephen. Take a look and a listen. Stephen, it's good to see you, sir. Thanks so much for joining me on the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I got to ask you, you got the Jeep shirt.
Yes.
Do you have any of the ducks? Do you have any ducks on your dashboard?
I do. I have three ducks. I actually love the ducking thing. That's one of the aspects of owning a Jeep, a Wrangler, that's really fun. You get kind of a communal thing going on with the Jeep wave. You wave at the other Wrangler people
right
on the street, and sometimes the people will put a duck on your Jeep, and you put ducks on other people's Jeeps. I don't know. It's just a fun little thing.
Do you have spare ducks in your Jeep to hand out to people?
I do.
Do you? That's
yes,
awesome.
I've got a bunch of them. We've got
now here's the other question. Is it just for Wranglers? Do you get upset when you see somebody with like a Grand Cherokee driving by and they got some ducks on the dash? Are you like, you're a poser?
I don't get upset at other Jeeps having them, or even I've seen like Teslas. Some Teslas will do it. Although I've never seen a Tesla be able to go off road like a Jeep can, but my Jeep is a plug-in hybrid, so I guess there's some more in common there. But it doesn't bother me when other people do it. But I don't put ducks on anything but Wranglers and Gladiators. I guess that's the truck version of a
right.
Wrangler. I try to keep to the original theme of the ducks, I guess.
I don't have a Wrangler. I do have another model of Jeep, and I'm actually with you because when I see
fancy Jeep.
It's a nice Jeep. I like
it. Very
cool.
Very cool.
But when I see, a Jeep Liberty or a Grand Cherokee and they got the ducks on the dash, I'm like, that's not for you. That's not your thing. That's a Wrangler thing. All right. Yeah. We did not invite you on here to talk about off-road vehicles.
Well, we could. I'd be happy to do that.
We need to do like a riding shotgun with Charlie style interview, and next time we have you on, maybe we can go for a ride in your Jeep off road,
in the Wrangler top down.
Exactly.
An episode there, that'd be good.
Yeah, fantastic. But it's funny. I mean, last week and really over the past couple of weeks, we've been so focused on what the language of the budget bill was going to look like, what was going to be in it. Was anything going to survive the parliamentarian's ruling? Was the Senate going to ignore the parliamentarian and, go ahead and reinsert the Finance Committee's language? All right. Well, now the One Big Beautiful Bill is signed. We know that taxes on suppressors, short-barreled firearms, any other weapons, they're going to be zeroed out starting on January the 1st. We know that there are lawsuits that are going to be filed. In fact, one already has been filed challenging the NFA as a result of the budget language. And so I'm just curious, I was thinking about this because, the summer is kind of a slow time of year for the news cycle generally. Now, the Trump administration, I think, makes things exciting. They have a tendency to, break news every day. But is there anything on your radar? Like, what do you think the next big story is for gun owners right now?
Yeah, well, keeping it to the theme that you just laid out there with these tax changes, I think certainly the lawsuits are what I'm looking for right now, because we've seen the text from the Gun Owners of America one with FRAC and the Silencer Shot Foundation. And we're still waiting on the NRA, SAF, FPC, ASA suit. So you kind of like every major gun group is kind of getting in on this. And I wonder if we might see more from, if NSSF is going to get involved from an industry perspective. or if National Association for Gun Rights, if they're planning to do anything, because it seems like everybody wants to get in on this. And it'll be interesting to see how those turn out. Now, obviously, that's a long game thing, right? We're not going to get a ruling in any of those cases probably for a while. The law doesn't even go into effect until January. You might even not see that NRA case until January. We'll have to figure out exactly what the timing is there, what circuit they're going to file in. Because GOA is in the Fifth Circuit, which is where you'd expect it to go. That's the most favorable one if you're a gun rights activist. But maybe the NRA case goes to the Eighth Circuit or the 11th Circuit or somewhere else where they might think they have a better, just diversify their odds. Because if they go to the Fifth Circuit, they might just get all combined into one case. So it'd be interesting to see how they play that and whether they have any different arguments than what GOA has put out. Because, they're the talking points that the two coalitions have used are pretty similar. So I don't know if they'll have anything else in that suit. So that I'm looking for that. And then, also the effect of the bill once it does hit. Now, I guess that is a little bit longer term, right? Because it doesn't hit until January. There's some confusing language in there. The guy initially wrote that it was going to be 90 days, but it's actually 90 days after the end of the quarter when it was signed. It's kind of confusing how it works, but bottom line is it doesn't hit until January.
So maybe a short-term impact of that, though, is what happens to these companies between now and January the 1st, right? Because I've got to think that a lot of consumers...
Yeah, they're going to wait, right?
Why not, right? I mean, if I've waited this long, I'm going to wait 6 more months, and that way I don't have to pay the $200 stamp, right?
Yeah. You might see some of these, there have been in the past promotions where they'll pay the stamp for you. Mm-hmm. So maybe you'll start seeing some of those crop up just to get sales, spread out a little bit so not everybody waits until the actual break happens.
Right. Because that's the other thing, right? I mean, if there's a glut of purchases January the 1st, the ATF has been better about processing these things. But if there's this deluge of applications, then I could see some delays coming into effect then too.
And that kind of goes into the next thing I was going to talk about too, is what becomes of this budget request that we've seen from DOJ? Where they want to slash, I think, almost $500 million from the ATF's budget. Now that's mostly in basically industry oversight. The IOIs is where they mainly want to cut. So it may not, hopefully it wouldn't have a direct impact on things like processing times. If you're, somebody who wants to go out and buy these and is not wanting to wait forever, like the has been the case in the past. But they do also talk about cutting the program that was successful in getting those processing times down, the digitization of a lot of what ATF does in terms of the registration process for NFA items, that's in this budget request now. And then obviously they even want to combine DEA and ATF. That's another big point. Will that actually happen? We've seen a lot of skepticism pretty much across the board from almost everyone except for DOJ leadership at this point has been against that idea. So whether that goes through will be a big thing. What the timetable would be on a move like that. I wouldn't be surprised if ATF's budget gets cut, right? That's probably something a lot of people in the administration and gun rights groups want to see, but they don't necessarily aren't on the same page about combining the ATF and DEA like the administration wants to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair to say. I was talking with Cody Wisniewski yesterday from FPC Action Foundation, and his question was, who actually wants this? Right? I mean, who's pushing for this? Because it's not the firearms industry, it's not Second Amendment organizations. Gun control groups hate it. This is one of the rare occasions where gun control groups and Second Amendment, for different reasons, but they both agree this would be a terrible idea.
Even the ATF doesn't like it, and the DEA, as far as I understand. I mean, I've talked to people at the ATF. They don't want this to happen. And then I don't think the DEA wants the accommodation either. I mean, the people who would want it, and this is not a new idea necessarily, right? This is something that was first proposed back in the Clinton administration. So it's been floating around there for decades now. And, the one upshot to it would be efficiency. So people, the whole DOGE thing, the idea of trying to combine agencies and find efficiencies through that process. So the concept would be you know, we've got duplicate leadership structures. Maybe we don't need that for these different federal law enforcement agencies, sort of centralizing federal power, which is another perhaps reason people might oppose it as well. But that's the basic argument, right? It's like, you could do this. Why do we need these groups separate? They often work together on, you know, drug and gun related enforcement. You know, we can save some money. We can consolidate these two federal agencies, and that seems to be the main idea. But you're, as you mentioned, not one that's winning over a lot of people directly involved in certainly the gun side of this fight.
Yeah. Now, speaking of ATF, I'm sure you saw this Washington Post story came out. I think it was early last week. Mm-hmm. ATF wanted to on July the 4th. Right. Release, you know, I think they were aiming for 47 regulatory changes. Then they said, well, we found a couple more. So they 50 regulatory changes is what we were told. Right.
Right.
I mean, I've looked at the ATF's website. I've looked at their Twitter account. I don't know if they're going on the Orthodox Independence Day calendar. So it's like 11 days later. I don't know what's going on, but I haven't seen anything about these regulations changing. Have you?
Yeah. I have not. I mean, other than we saw two.
Right.
Right.
Those came out actually before the Washington Post story.
Right. Right. So, that, you know, the Washington Post story, when I read it, was a little confusing to me, to be honest. Not that I doubt their sourcing or anything, but just, I don't know, maybe somebody inside of DOGE was kind of playing up the fact that they're over there now. And now we're really going to see some change. Because what it described to me was what, you know, a guy like Robert Leiter, who's now the chief counsel at ATF, had basically promised to do going in, and what they've already said they were going to do. So that's another short-term thing you can look for, is some of this rollback of these rules at the ATF. And also, I had like some skepticism about the 50 things by July 4th. If they're going to do that, it'd have to be relatively minor things, like what they had like the simunition imports and the
barrels, right? Yeah,
like relatively minor stuff that they can just change on their own, because the bigger ticket items that a lot of gun rights activists in the industry want to see rolled back, they, you know, the Biden stuff, the things that President Biden had done by the ATF when he was in office, the reality is that requires rulemaking of its own to undo. Right. And that's like a year long process. And they're already supposedly working on that. You know, everything we've heard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, you're right. They're supposedly working on it. And I have no reason to doubt that. But at the same time,
we haven't heard news of it yet.
It's July, right? Yeah. And we have not seen any of Biden's rules. We've not seen any of those, you know, formally repeat, or even like the process has not begun. Right.
At least not formally. They may have started some sort of informal process.
Right, but nothing's been published in the Federal Register, right? Nothing has come out. And we're talking again about the engaged in the business rule. We've been told that that's not really being enforced. The stabilizing brace rule, we've been told that that's, you know, kind of on ice anyway because of the court rulings. Mm-hmm. But even the frame and receiver rule that was upheld by the Supreme Court, right? That was a Biden-era rule. Is that going to be rolled back? Is that going to be repealed? And I mean, again, you're right. It takes a little bit of time, but it's also July. It has been a little bit of time since we've heard that those rules were going away, right?
That's a fair point. Yes. Now, the last public announcement I recall on this, when they said they were going to look at these rules with the intention of repealing them, it did say that it was going to be months, and that was several months ago, mm-hmm. and they were going to work with. But you're right. I mean, I would, once you get like the formal process itself takes a long time. And now it's been delayed several months to even get to the formal process. And so I think, that's another thing to watch for. What is actually going to come of this? And are we going to get, what are these 50 rules they're looking at rolling back? Are they more minor stuff? Is there some, like, is there other stuff that maybe hasn't been the focus of public attention for a while, but might still be exciting for gun rights activists or the gun industry? You know, so what the ATF actually does on this front over the next couple of months is another thing to, and if they don't do anything, that in and of itself starts to become a story at some point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, again, a lot of stuff on the horizon, maybe. But you know, again, I mean, with the ATF stuff, I mean, some of that could be imminent, right? We just don't know when those changes are going to drop.
The other thing I would mention too with ATF is we saw there was you know, obviously there's been a lot of controversy around federal agents wearing masks, mainly in immigration
enforcement,
and that's been. Hasn't touched on guns as much in that regard, but ATF has been involved in a couple of those raids. Not necessarily the most controversial ones, but there have been a few. And they did. There was a period where you did see ATF agents masking at a single event in Minneapolis. Now that was part of not just a general immigration enforcement. And we haven't seen ATF really get involved in the just rounding people up at Home Depot type of situations. Mm-hmm. They have really stuck. It appears. Towards their mission goal of like if there's some sort of firearms related crime or explosives or you know, whatever else ATF directly oversees, they'll be involved in you know if there's a crossover. And you know, one thing I'm honestly going to look for is will ATF agents start to mask more often? Now they told me at that Minneapolis raid that that only happened because a crowd gathered and there was like pepper spray used, and so it was. They claimed it was a sort of PPE, improvised PPE on the, you know, protective equipment on the part of the ATF agents. People can judge for themselves on, you know, how that is. But they said, essentially, this is not our new policy. We're not going to be masking regularly as ATF agents. And, you know, I think there would be a lot more sensitivity around that in the gun community if ATF agents started doing it in particular, more so than ICE or Border Patrol. And so that's something I'm going to watch for, just to see, you know, how is ATF going to evolve their enforcement methods in public?
Yeah.
And one of the things they said is like, ATF doesn't do a lot of crowd control stuff. And that was part of the reason why.
Right. But they are doing more of it now under the Trump administration, right? They're working with ICE. They're working with these other agencies on immigration enforcement. So
how does ATF's on the ground tactics change, if they change at all, and how will gun owners and gun rights groups react to that? It hasn't been very controversial to this point, but it could become controversial depending on what path they go down.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll throw two other things out there. Supreme Court begins on summer recess, but there are a number of cases that are going to be awaiting the justices when they return. And we've got some deadlines coming up here in some of these cases. So Vincent versus Bondi, the government's response is due later this week, I believe, July the 11th. This is Melinda Vincent. She was 20 some odd years ago, Stephen. She wrote a bad check for about $500. Mm-hmm. Sentenced, I believe, to probation, but she could have gone to prison. She was a drug addict. She was homeless at the time. She has since apparently turned her life around. She's a counselor herself now. She has a private practice. She works with the state of Utah. And the 10th Circuit said, yeah, you don't get to have a gun. You know, you committed a prohibited offense, and that's it. You're a prohibited person forevermore. So DOJ is going to have its reply brief due, I believe, on the 11th. And then the other one that's coming up, I mean, there are a couple of other prohibited person cases, Hamani and Daniels dealing with unlawful drug use. Those petitions are coming up. I believe the government's response is due July 21st. Also July 21st, NRA versus Glass. That's the challenge to Florida's ban on gun sales to under 21s. Mm. The reply, so the cert petition has been filed by the NRA. The state of Florida's reply brief is due July 21st. And this is the case where Florida's attorney general has said, I don't want to defend the law. So I'm really curious to see what the state of Florida's reply brief actually looks like coming up here in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, and maybe you'll have an outside group defend the law instead. You know, that happens occasionally in those sorts of situations. But I think it'd be really interesting to see what DOJ says in that nonviolent felon case, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's very similar to the Brian Range case out of Pennsylvania,
which they Third Circuit did not appeal the Third Circuit's decision saying that Brian mm-hmm. Range should get his gun rights back. They just kind of quietly dropped that case, right?
Yeah, but their explanation, at least not in court, but to some Democratic senators who had asked about it, their explanation was that the court, that they didn't think it was an expansive ruling, and they didn't seem to agree with the actual outcome either, though. They've recommended that the court not take up these kind of cases because they don't think there's enough of a circuit split, and they don't think that the range case, for instance, changes the law enough. So they seem to be, at least so far, on the side of leaving the status quo as it is.
I mean, there's a circuit split between the Third Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, Melinda Vincent's case, right? Yeah, so
DOJ has tried to minimize the ruling in range in that regard. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see when pressed what they're going to argue in court and whether how vigorously they're going to defend the law on specifically when it comes to nonviolent offenders and whether that is, for the DOJ, I think, one of the most important laws because it's one of the most prosecuted laws, felon in possession. Mm-hmm. And it is one of these, like, you don't have to actually catch the person doing anything beyond possessing a gun to get a conviction in cases like that, which is right. Makes things a bit easier on you as a prosecutor, certainly. But, obviously the DOJ now has they've been told by the president that they need to take as pro-gun positions, pro-Second Amendment positions. And so there's sort of a bit of a tension there. Same thing for, several other cases. One of the trends that we've noticed, at least, I'd be interested in your thoughts on it too, just like DOJ has been a lot more aggressive at going after state laws that they think are incompatible with the Second Amendment than they have been about going after federal laws, mm-hmm. refusing to defend federal laws. And so that's something that we've noticed in how they've approached things so far. Like, they'll get involved in cases that the federal government's not even party to, right? To say, especially in blue state laws, right? Especially California,
right?
That their laws are unconstitutional, that they violate the Second Amendment, but they're a lot less interested in doing that with federal laws to this point. And so, whether that trend continues or if DOJ starts to shift strategy even more towards, pro-gun positions, I think that'll be something to watch for. And that'll be something these court cases are, we might not get a lot of legislative change at either the state or federal level because we're going to be outside of the legislative season here soon. Mm-hmm. But the courts are going to operate all year, and they're going to be giving us information that's going to be vital to both, how the Supreme Court might shape up, whether they're interested at all in Second Amendment stuff. I know that's the feeling that a lot of people have watching the court is that it's just very, it's just not interested in doing a lot of Second Amendment litigation, even though it just invented a new standard.
Yeah.
It's not really litigating that stuff, not yet at least. And then how the DOJ itself is looking at Second Amendment cases at both a state level and a federal level we'll get a lot of information on that, I think, coming in the next few months here.
I hope that you are correct. Well, Stephen, as always, I appreciate you coming on the program. May the ducks be with you. And I look forward to having you back here very soon, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Stephen Gutowski from The Reload with us here on Barron Arms, Cam & Company. My thanks to Stephen for joining us on the program. Make sure, by the way, if you're not a subscriber to The Reload, that you do so just as soon as you become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member at Barron Arms. All right. On to today's Armed Citizen story. Our good deed of the day and our recidivist report. This is a strange one, I got to tell you, from the Lone Star State of Texas. Men plead guilty to lesser charges of manslaughter, get probation in 2023 deadly shooting case. KWES in Midland, Odessa, reports that both Omar Matthew Gutierrez and Thomas Terrazas, who were accused of murdering a 15-year-old boy, ended up taking plea deals to a lesser charge of manslaughter, according to disposition records that the TV station obtained on Saturday. Both of them given 10 years probation for the manslaughter charge. Gutierrez was also given an additional 10 years of community supervision for an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon charge. Now, the TV station originally reported that Gutierrez had admitted to shooting the 15-year-old while Terrazas stood by. The TV station also reported that Gutierrez had shot at a witness as well. So it sounds like, even if, and again, we don't have a lot of the details here, but even if prosecutors felt like, all right, well, maybe there's a self-defense claim here against the 15-year-old was the initial aggressor. I mean, when you shoot at a witness, that kind of takes away any real self-defense argument, at least in that particular shooting, right? But according to the TV station, if both of the men finish the terms of their probation without violating it, the charges will be stripped from the record. The TV station also reported that both were accused of robbing the teenage victim, but those robbery charges were dismissed. And by the way, while Gutierrez was out on bond, he was charged with another robbery in April of last year. He was also given 10 years of probation for that charge as well. So, I mean, again, I would love to hear from the district attorney here. Was there some sort of element of self-defense? How does somebody go from murder to manslaughter and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and robbery and walk away with probation in all of those cases? I mean, I realize that these stories happen in every state of the union, but this is a sentence that you would expect to see in, I don't know, Washington, D.C., Chicago, San Francisco. Not West Texas. This is really bizarre. We'll see if we can find out any more information. Today's Armed Citizen story, also a bizarre one and a tragedy. Deputies in South Carolina say a man was forced to kill his son in self-defense after his son attacked him in the home. 911 call was made shortly after midnight on Saturday. There was an argument inside the home in Anderson County, South Carolina. When first responders arrived, they found a 44-year-old Clyde Eugene Davis III suffering from multiple gunshot wounds, and he passed away at the scene. The Anderson County Sheriff's Office says that Davis had threatened to kill his father. He actually tried to strangle him while his father was laying in bed. Davis III was armed with a weapon as well prior to the shooting. Deputies say the father managed to grab a gun during the struggle, shot his son in self-defense. Based on evidence and interviews with witnesses, deputies said the incident is a justifiable homicide. Now, yeah, I mean, I cannot imagine what that dad is going through right now. As a father myself, it's horrifying to think of one of your own children trying to murder you and then being forced to kill your child to save your own life. It is just a unbelievable tragedy. But I am grateful and glad that the elder Davis was in fact able to protect himself in these horrific and horrendous circumstances. Finally today, our good deed of the day, also speaking of some horrific and horrendous circumstances, the flash flooding in Texas. There are obviously a lot of unresolved questions about how much advance warning was given to some residents, but there are also so many stories of heroism that are emerging from the aftermath of the floodwaters. This one from USA Today, with just word-of-mouth warning. One man raced 25 miles to save guests at his Texas RV park. The owner of this RV park, a guy named David Chambers, said he was stunned that they only got about a half-hour warning. But it did, I guess, give him enough time to race to his resort, which was nicknamed named the Guadalupe Keys Resort. Had 9 fully furnished RVs at a small sandy beach by the Guadalupe River. And Chambers, again, early on the morning of July the 4th, was alerted to what was going on and was able to get there. Yelling into one RV after another, "You got to get out, you got to get out." All 15 people who were there at the campground for the 4th of July weekend did make it out of those RVs, which were swept away, and they did make it to higher ground. So all of them safe, again, because of the quick thinking and the fast action of David Chambers, who also, again, says that he would like to know why there wasn't more advance notice. And that is something that is on the minds of a lot of folks. He said he didn't even know of any flood potential until he got a phone call at his home from his partner, Drew Yancey, who was staying on the property, who said, hey, the river's starting to rise. And so he got in his car, drove the 25 miles to the park, got there. He said, just as the river was spilling over its banks, about 6:29 in the morning on July the 4th, he saw a 4-foot-high wall of water rolling down the river towards him, all kinds of debris there in the water. He said he sprinted up the shore. He and another worker began banging on the RV doors and didn't stop until all 15 customers had left the property. Yesterday, RVs stacked up on top of one another in the corner of a park. One flipped upside down. Several others had just been swept away downstream. Chambers said that one of the shipping containers containing tools and other belongings was spotted by a friend in Waring, Texas. It was about 15 miles down the Guadalupe River. Chambers, by the way, yesterday was his 77th birthday. And he celebrated it, that's the word you want to use, using a chainsaw to hack down downed trees. There were volunteers who had come out to help clean out the property. He says that he does plan to rebuild, but he will not put RVs near the riverbank again. But he also says if he's going to rebuild, the county and state should come up with a better warning system. He says America always reacts and never tries to prevent. We need to start preventing. Well, I'm glad that he was able to prevent the loss of life there on the 4th of July in the right place, at least willing and able to get to the right place in time to do the right thing. David Chambers in Center Point, Texas, we thank you. And again, all of the countless heroes and good Samaritans, we thank you for your very, very good deeds. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Don't forget, Wednesdays, by the way, 1:30 Eastern, I do a weekly live chat with Hot Air's Ed Morrissey for our VIP Gold and VIP Platinum members. Would love for you to be a part of it. It is one of my it probably is my favorite hour of the work week, honestly, and I would love for you to join us. All you have to do, go to BearingArms.com/subscribe, sign up, become a VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. You get all kinds of great benefits, not only at Bearing Arms, but across the Town Hall Media family of websites like Hot Air, Red State, Twitchy, Town Hall, obviously, and more. It is it's a great way to support the work that we're doing here at Bearing Arms, and we certainly do appreciate your support. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.